That line's Iran's leader calls for a lasting ceasefire in Yemen and advises Saudi rulers not to continue a war they are not going to win. Russia's Putin says the most important conclusion from the Ukraine war is that the unipolar world order built by the United States is falling apart. And also, the Biden administration preparing a new arms package worth $750 million for Ukraine as early as next week. Hello and welcome, everybody. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says Saudi Arabia does not have a chance of winning its war on Yemen, urging the kingdom to stop its aggression there. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, with the efforts of the Yemeni people and the courage of their leaders, a Saudi victory is impossible. He called on Saudi officials to find a way out of this war. Iran's leader expressed support for negotiations and a lasting ceasefire in Yemen and praised the patience of the people of that country. Yemen has been devastated by war-ravaged Saudi Arabia and some of its Arab allies in March 2015. According to the UN, more than 300,000 Yemenis have been killed through direct or indirect causes such as hunger. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC, renews revenge calls for the U.S. assassination of top Iranian commander and anti-terror figure, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Commander of the IRGC Ground Force, Brigadier General Mohammad Pakpour, says Iran has taken a series of powerful and devastating retaliatory measures against the U.S. and Israel. He said those measures are in addition to Iranian missile attacks that hit a U.S. airbase in Iraq on January 8, 2020, 5 days after Soleimani was killed. Pakpour added that even if all American leaders are killed, it will not be enough to avenge General Soleimani's death. The IRGC commander also hailed Iran's deterrence capabilities, saying the country is ready to repel foreign threats. He stressed that Iran's enemies no longer have the strength to take any action against the Islamic Republic. Afghans have condemned a recent stabbing attack at Imam Reza Shrine in Iran's northeastern city of Mashhad, extending their sympathy and solidarity with the families of the victims and all Iranian people. Rahmatullah Baghban has filed this report for us from Kabul.
As a neighboring country, Iran has always been a second house for Afghans. Over 5 million Afghan refugees are living in Iran today. Following a stabbing attack at Imam Reza Shrine in Mashhad that left two clerics dead, the Afghan society condemned the move, extending messages of solidarity and sympathy with the Iranian people.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has been a kind host to millions of Afghan refugees for more than four decades. Iran provides our Afghan legal and illegal refugees with jobs as well as educational, medical and other facilities. I wish Iranians enjoy peace and condemn any attack on their country as it has served as a second home for Afghan people.
I extend my deep condolences to the Iranian people over the barbaric attack on a number of clerics at Imam Reza Holy Shrine. Not only me, but also the whole Afghan nation were saddened after the attack. The enemies of Islam and the two nations are pushing conspiracies to sow sedition, but we won't let anyone to ruin our solidarity.
Afghans also echo Iran's voice against enemies' plots and Cold War. Experts say neither the knife attacker in Mashhad represents Afghans, nor allegations of Iran mistreating Afghan refugees are true. They believe enemies of the two nations are using the media to sow discord.
The Mashhad incident that left two clerics dead was orchestrated by Takfiri groups and the enemies of Iran and Afghanistan. We should be aware that how they are trying to target our friendship. The stabbing attacker never represents the Afghan people, but it was meant to push Afghanophobia in Iran. On the other hand, the West is sowing Iranophobia in Afghanistan by fake viral pictures, while we know that Iran is generously hosting Afghan refugees.
This comes as the two nations are expanding relations in different political, cultural, and economic areas. The two neighboring countries, Iran and Afghanistan, have long been close partners. People here thank Iran for peacefully housing millions of Afghan refugees. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The unipolar international order the U.S. has built after the Cold War is breaking up. That's according to the Russian president. Vladimir Putin believes the end of such order is the most important strategic conclusion from Russia's military operation in Ukraine. The Russian president made the comments at a meeting with his Belarusian counterpart on Tuesday. Putin said Russia will calmly continue its Ukraine operation until the goals are achieved. He called the situation in Ukraine a tragedy, but said Moscow had no other choice. Putin said Russia has to fight to prevent Ukraine from becoming a springboard for Moscow's enemies. He also called the anti-Russia sanctions imposed by the West as an economic blitzkrieg that has failed. And the U.S. president says he stands by his assertion that Russian troops are committing, quote, genocide in Ukraine.
Yes, I call this genocide because it's become clearer and clearer that Putin is just trying to wipe out the idea of unity between Ukraine. And the evidence is mounting. Different than it was last week, the more evidence is coming out of the horrible things that the Russians have done in Ukraine.
Joe Biden, however, says it'll be up to international lawyers to determine whether or not the Russian forces' conduct in Ukraine qualifies as genocide. Biden had earlier called for President Putin to face trial over Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Kiev claims it has recovered the bodies of hundreds of civilians who were executed by Russian soldiers in the city of Bucha. The Kremlin dismisses the allegation as false, arguing that Ukraine has staged the videos of the bodies to pin the blame on Moscow and justify the anti-Russia sanctions. On this segment of the news review, the U.S. is preparing to announce a new military aid package for Ukraine in its war with Russia, now in its 49th day. Reuters, citing American officials, says the package could be worth $750 million and will be announced as early as this week. It includes new capabilities such as unmanned surface vehicles and helicopters. The military aid is believed to be specifically aimed at helping Ukraine fight Russia in the eastern Donbass region. Ukraine and its Western allies believe that Russia is preparing to take Donbass. The region includes the pro-Russian self-proclaimed republics of Luhansk and Donetsk. Last week, the White House said it has provided over $1.7 billion in military aid to Ukraine since the beginning of the war. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have John White, writer and political analyst, joining us from Edinburgh. And also Samuel Geddes, journalist, joining us from Melbourne. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. White in Edinburgh. How is the West's arms supply for Ukraine affecting this conflict, in your opinion? Is it prolonging the war? Is it helping boost Ukraine's defenses in a meaningful way? How do you see it?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. It's doing both of those things. The first and foremost, the priority for the West is clearly to prolong the war as long as possible in order to deplete Russian military forces in Ukraine. And Joe Biden and his counterpart in London, Boris Johnson, are willing to fight to the last drop of Ukrainian blood in order to do so. It's only prolonged the inevitable, however. The Russians are about to embark on its major offensive, which is major strategic objective throughout this conflict, which is to take the Donbass. And they've surrounded the bulk of Ukraine's armed forces there in the, around 40,000 men. And so that's going to be a major offensive. And once they bring their firepower to bear, no matter the cost, given the statements and the sentiments expressed by President Putin recently on the necessity for this conflict, then the Ukrainians will lose at huge cost. And the only strategy that Mr. Zelensky has at this juncture is to try and drag the West into direct military conflict with Russia. And I think this is the source of the claim of chemical weapons being used in Mariupol by Russian forces against the last holdouts of the Azov neo-Nazi battalion there.
Samuel, some NATO members fear that supplying Ukraine with heavier offensive arms could lead to direct confrontation with Russia. Do you see it in that light as well? Are those fears justified?
Well, I think they certainly are justified if Russia were to end up targeting those arms transfers, which would obviously involve the risk of killing citizens of NATO member countries, then yes, that would be an extremely dangerous escalation. As well as echoing what John said about the principally the United States wanting to prolong the conflict, obviously for geopolitical reasons in terms of weakening Russia and bleeding it dry, I would say that in general, the war seems as though in the immediate and medium term it will be enormously economically lucrative for the United States. Not only has it really reshaped the energy system in the US's favor, as it will now be supplying a large share of Europe's energy needs into the future, but it has more or less effectively cornered the global agricultural, petrochemical, fertilizer, and of course arms industries that both Russia and Ukraine were key players in before the war, and from now on it seems will very likely not be. So that means an enormously enlarged market share for key US industries. So I think, I mean, I can't say that I have direct evidence of that, but it would seem that that may well be a motivating factor in the US willingness to, as John said, fight Russia down to the last Ukrainian.
Well, gentlemen, stay with us as we want to take a look at some online reactions to this news. Reactions from the first user, Representative Press, writes, there is no winning for Ukraine. More weapons are going to get more people killed. Ukraine should accept Russia's conditions to end the war. That's the only path that will save the most lives. JJNT writes, the beneficiary of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine is the United States. One, it's able to sell expensive oil and gas to Europe. Two, it's able to sell weapons to Ukraine. I firmly believe that if the US and NATO do not send weapons to Ukraine, the war must end and peace will come. And our last reaction, Tintin in the Land of Soviets writes, Ukraine has a right to have whatever weapons it wants. Russia promised Ukraine territorial integrity for dismantling their nukes. Russia broke that promise. Now Ukraine shall have the right to bring nuclear capabilities back and aim them at Kremlin. Back to our guest, John White. Ukraine has been complaining about Western arms not coming in quick enough, and the U.S. has said that the Ukraine, Kiev, will need months of training in order to operate some of the weapons systems. Why do you think the U.S. is moving slowly in providing this heavier artillery?
Well, it's not an easy thing to do logistically. There's also various checks and balances that have to be met. There's a system of process that has to be signed off by various departments. They are funneling weapons in though at quite an impressive speed, or have been. And I think the ante will be up with the start of this major Russian offensive in the Donbass. Boris Johnson, when he was in Kiev recently to visit Mr. Zelensky, promised 120 British armored vehicles, and that's going to involve Ukrainian forces who are going to be operating those vehicles, travelling to the UK to learn how to operate them. Some of this equipment is very technically advanced and it needs some training, and up to a few months training. So it's interesting to see how the American, in terms of their intelligence, believe this war is going to go. They obviously think they're in for a long war in the Donbass, and they will have time to train up the various Ukrainian servicemen and people who are going to be operating the equipment that they are intent on supplying. I don't know where the American intelligence get their sources from. I think there's been a lot of misinformation coming from the West about the supposed failure of this Russian offensive or Russian military operation or campaign. I don't think Russia ever intended, for example, to take Kiev as stated. I think the objective there was to pin down Ukrainian forces in and around Kiev so that they could not reinforce the bulk of the Ukrainian army deployed in the Donbass as the Russians set about systematically encircling it. They've now done that, and as I said, they're ready to embark on a huge military offensive. But one of the major issues, and my interlocutor there was very eloquent in establishing the economic impulse and the fact that America now enjoys geopolitical dominance over Europe in a way it has not for some years, is the NATO factor. We heard only a few months ago, Emmanuel Macron was talking up the idea of a European Union separate, independent military force. That's going to be blown into the water after this. NATO has now come back to the fore, and this will cement NATO's status within Western military and security apparatus as the tip of the spear of Western hegemony.
Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Writer and political analyst John White joining us from Edinburgh. And thanks to journalist Sam Ugetti joining us from Melbourne. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. Italy's economy, already tested by 2 years of anti-pandemic measures, is further suffering from sanctions imposed on Moscow by the members of the European Union following the war in Ukraine. Inflation in Italy continues to grow as authorities fear serious repercussions on the country's society. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Imran Khan succumbed to U.S. gamesmanship because of his refusal to bow to Washington's dictates to cancel his scheduled state visit to Moscow on the threshold of the Ukraine crisis and his presence in the Russian capital. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan, international staff writer. This article is published under the heading, The U.S. Bows Out Imran Khan. Stay tuned for more. Pakistan, which has rarely experienced political stability since its foundation in 1947, has seen the exit of yet another prime minister without completing his term. The removal of Imran Khan Niazi through a no-confidence vote by the minimum majority of MPs following a high-pitched drama that saw the 342-seat parliament dissolved by the president in a bid to save the prime minister and then restored to power by the Supreme Court in a few days means that it is not the masses or the common man who control the destiny of Pakistan, but persons with vested interest, the powerful military chiefs, the politicians influenced by foreign forces rather than concerned about the sovereignty of the country. The flamboyant cricketer and a world-class all-rounder who, as captain, had led Pakistan to victory in 1992 World Cup, the only instance for the country has failed as a political leader to steer Pakistan to triumph through the maze of the national economy dominated by corrupt elements and on the international scene where there is no fair play because the U.S. is the main spoil sport. As a matter of fact, it was the U.S. through its vicious spin on the Pakistan pitch that brought about the dismissal of the master batsman who had skillfully played on different turfs of the cricketing world. Imran Khan succumbed to U.S. gamesmanship because of his refusal to bow to Washington's dictates, to cancel his scheduled state visit to Moscow and the threshold of the Ukraine crisis, and his presence in the Russian capital. He expressed regret when American pressures made the coalition allies of his Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf PTI to withdraw support and render his party a minority in order to start the process of no-confidence vote against him. Perhaps it was his spirit of fair play that made him openly criticize U.S. meddling in Pakistan's affairs that the distanced the generals and the political elite from him because of the exposure of their unexplained awe of Washington, despite the fact that various American administrations have never treated Pakistan fairly. Thus, it seems it was Imran Khan's independence, stand, and respect for national sovereignty that led to his exit from the political field, rather than what his critics alleged to be a deepening economic crisis and double-digit inflation, factors that have always plagued Pakistan since its birth because of over-reliance on the Arab donors, such as Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which used their monetary grants and loans as levers to deter Pakistan's progress and development in spite of being a nuclear power. An example in this regard is Islamabad's lack of guts to implement the peace pipeline project for import of natural gas from the Islamic Republic of Iran for national development because of not just American pressures, but threats from Riyadh and Abu Dhabi to cut all economic aid. Imran may be back in the pavilion, but according to the Pakistani media, whatever his shortcomings, most Pakistanis still see him in the roles of a crowd-pulling cricketer, a philanthropist who built a famous cancer hospital in Lahore after retirement from sports, and a politician who was not allowed to carry out his reforms.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The French presidential election in 2022 is here, and the results so far show a downturn in the participation rate, around 65%, down sharply from the same point back in the year 2017 when elections took place. The obvious question, why do French voters feel that they should not come out and vote like before, especially during uncertain economic times? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Emmanuel Macron, the current president's five-year report card, and why the contender Marine Le Pen actually has gained in popularity. And we will also take a look at the Muslim vote and why Macron may have lost that demographic. First, let's get an idea about some of the results that have come out from our correspondent, Rami Mazari, who joins us from Paris to tell us about that.
The first round of the French presidential election is finished, and as expected, there will be a repeat of 2017. Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen will duel once again in the second round of voting.
Maybe the French people will surprise everyone and elect Marine Le Pen. This is her second time making it to the second round, and maybe people will give her a chance. But I think Macron will win because too many people are either scared to vote for Le Pen or feel they will be disappointed by her.
I think Macron is brilliant and that he has handled the coronavirus crisis very well. Le Pen is too racist and too extreme right.
Macron's team brushed off recent polls that actually have Le Pen winning in the second round, as she has soared in the last month to make the race a dead heat. In a close third place, just 1% behind Le Pen, was Jean-Luc Mélenchon, a former Socialist Party minister who turned left. In a bid to win over centrists, he didn't embrace the yellow vests, and barring a huge cache of votes somewhere, he's headed home and perhaps has aged out of politics. In fourth place, with a disappointing 7%, was mainstream media pundit Eric Zemmour, who was seemingly given control of the campaign agenda for months, despite setting new lows in Islamophobia and racism. The mainstream conservative candidate, Valérie Pécresse, was a distant fifth. The so-called Sarkozyist candidate didn't even get the endorsement of former President Nicolas Sarkozy. The once mighty Socialist Party might be finished after garnering less than 2%, and only the two communist candidates scored less. Finishing a surprising seventh was Jean Lassalle, the only MP to wear a yellow vest in French Parliament. Parliament immediately suspended itself, and Lassalle was fined.
Is Le Pen still so shocking after 5 years of Macronism and in a post-Donald Trump world? Has Macron provided enough stability in a post-coronavirus landscape? We'll have the verdict of France's voters on April 24th. Rami Mazari, Paris.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Jeff Brown, radio host and journalist, joins us from Normandy. Also joining us, Arnold August, an author and journalist who joins us from Montreal.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Jeff Brown, let me first start with you. So we're looking at a turnout that's 4 percentage points lower than at the same stage that occurred back in 2017. At the same time, based on the initial results, Macron seen a 29.5%, Le Pen 23.5%. Your initial reaction to that?
Well, this is exactly what happened in 2017, and my wife and I voted in that election, and we voted in the election today. And the problem is that the press is totally controlled by the elites. And what's going to happen now in round two is that they will totally demonize Le Pen and call her a fascist, radical, racist, extremist, to push the people towards Macron. And in 2017, and before the first round, they made her look like she was an angel and a princess and a wonderful lady. And no, she's not that bad, and she's not that radical, because they did not want Mélenchon to get into the final round, because I think he's the only candidate that might have any chance of beating Macron. So here we are again, the left with seven parties, all splintered. If all of those parties had backed Mélenchon, Mélenchon would be going against Macron in the second round.
Why didn't they?
And I think he could beat him.
Why do you think they didn't? At this point, do we have any who have endorsed either?
Well, the left in France has always been highly splintered. You've got communists and Workers' Party, and then the socialists, ecologists. Two or three different communist parties, and there's a lot of infighting, a lot of jealousy, a lot of the left here has been talking forever about a unified left, and the last time that happened, Mitterrand got elected, and that has not happened since.
Okay, Arnold August, looking over here, moving to the second round with obviously Macron and Le Pen, if you haven't heard. Let's break this down a little bit and first talk about whichever you like. Let's pick Le Pen. What do you think of Le Pen? She's being described, as our guest there said back in 2017, of being an extremist and so forth and so on, but now she has portrayed and been successful in portraying herself as somewhat more moderate. And that obviously was to allay any concerns that the voters may have. Do you agree with that? What are your views on Le Pen?
Well, of course, yeah, she is definitely, and this is always the case in these type of elections, such as in France or United States or Canada, people on the right try to shift change their appearance to be, more moderate in order to try to get some more votes. But one thing is very interesting, talking about trying to be more moderate, is that she actually visited Moscow, I think, in 2017, and she came back saying that she had a high regard for President Putin. Of course, now Macron is fighting against that, saying, showing pictures of her in Moscow and trying to denigrate her with regards to the international affairs of being soft on Russia. So, it's a shift. It's a mixed ground. I mean, there's no clear way that one could describe Le Pen at this time, because everything is shifting according to circumstances, with the one and only goal, trying to get votes.
When we take a look at the way that you said, Jeff Brown, that the media controls the way that these contenders and the incumbent is portrayed, perhaps showing the pluses and minuses, what is the real story, do you think? For example, we had our correspondent when he spoke to us saying that 7 out of 10 voters actually support Macron, but we're not seeing that at the polls. Or support Le Pen? Is that how? What is the deal? I mean, who has more popularity here?
Before every election, everyone who's registered to vote here receives a packet of information with the platform for all, and there were 12 candidates, mind you, which is too many. That's part of the problem with the French electoral system. And when you read Le Pen's platform, I don't think she's radical at all. She is definitely more, much, much more liberal than any Republican.
Give us one point that stands out.
Well, one point, she has a very socialist-minded, in terms of the 99% medical care, taking care of the people, providing, public services, et cetera. In fact, her economic advisor came from the Socialist Party. The only thing that she gets demonized here for is because she's the daughter of Mr. Le Pen, who was much more overtly racist. Le Pen is just against immigration, but that is not an unpopular platform around the world. And so, I mean, to be honest with you, other than the fact that she's against immigration, she's as far as I'm concerned, she's as much on the left as some of the other left-wing candidates. So the problem is the press is going to absolutely push her, or they're going to destroy her in the next 2 weeks, because we have to wait 2 weeks for the second round on the 24th. They will destroy her, and the other thing is Macron is, he's not middle of the road. He's a neoliberal right winger. He's a very neoliberal. World Economic Forum, Council on Foreign Relations. He is more right wing than Le Pen, but the press will make sure that that's not how it's portrayed, and that's the big problem here. Is the mass media, what I call the big lie propaganda machine, is what it decides who gets elected, unfortunately.
So let's put that into perspective, if we can, or if you can, Arnold August. We know that Marine Le Pen, one of the platforms that she ran on is the fact that she wants to somehow focus on the cost of living crisis and be able to tame that. Of course, we know that that's a huge problem for the French. Now, Macron, on the other hand, I'm not too sure how well he has done. They're touting a 7% GDP growth, but then when you take a look at the real figures, you can see that the deficit is still high. You're having a manufacturer base in France that's gone out of business. They're not doing that well. And also, we're looking at one of the worst inflations when it comes to energy. So who stands better? Who can fare better under those circumstances, you think?
Well, I think that, describing these specific programs of these two candidates, I don't think that it has very much currency or very much legitimacy amongst the population. Here in Montreal, there's a large number of French citizens, of course, who are voting today. And speaking briefly with them over the last few days, their frustration is, how come? I mean, the previous speaker talked about the role of the media. It's very important. And I think the most important feature of the media in these elections is they focus solely on Le Pen and Macron, as if these are the only two candidates that count, that have a chance of winning. So it's like a vicious circle. They avoid talking about Mélenchon, and they concentrate on the other two, making it like a sure bet that there's no chance for Mélenchon can win, and one only the other two can win. Now, as far as I know, the Mélenchon has a 11% rating amongst the voters. In other words, it's quite important. And I, speaking to my friends here in Montreal who are voting, they're very disappointed that this time the Communist Party of France did not sit it out as they did previously and openly support Mélenchon. And if they would have done that, I think we would be in a different situation now, far more solid, with chances very much improved for Mélenchon to actually get into that second round. And I think that if one look at his general program internationally and nationally, it is very good. It's a solid left-wing program. There's no real reason why the Communist Party of France did not drop their own, sectarian, if I may use the word, interests and goals, and in support, put all their backing in support of Donald Trump. He's a very dynamic person. And the fact that the media are just ignoring him, we may be in for some kind of a surprise, because the voter turnout is so low. It is mainly because people have no confidence in the two main candidates and their programs, which more often than not seem to be just, well, platitudes to try to get votes, is very obvious. And we could actually have a surprise this Sunday with regards to Mallinckrodt. Let us see.
Well, we need to talk about the economy a little bit more here, Jeff Brown. And I'm looking at comments made back in 2017, because I had a record of that. And one of them said, you can't make it to the end of the month. This is just one of the French protesters, which we'll talk about where he was protesting. You can't make it to the end of the month, even with two salaries. Looking at some of the comments now made by some of the French, they're still struggling to make ends meet. So what has Macron done? And we're looking again at the voter focus, which is during this post, if I can call it that, post-COVID era, whether the French government under Macron can handle what's coming its way, as opposed to Le Pen.
Well, since 2017, Macron, you have to understand that Macron is a neoliberal Trojan horse. He is a Rothschild regent. He was cultivated by the Rothschild family, Goldman Sachs. He is an elitist and has absolutely no concern whatsoever for the common man. In fact, he's going to give his speech tonight at Versailles, you know, where Louis, where, you know, Louis the 14th was, you know, but the problem is that, I mean, everything has gone south since the European treaty in 2007. Salaries are going nowhere. Inflation's going up. Social services for the 99% are being slashed. Since Macron got elected in 2017, just one example, 17,000 hospital beds have been shut down. Taxes have been raised on the 99%. Taxes have been lowered on the 1%. Austerity has been increased on the 99%. Austerity doesn't exist for the 1%. That's why the yellow vests have been out there for the last 3 years, and Rahman Mazahiri has done a brilliant job. They express the frustration, and we live here. A year ago, we bought 1,000 liters of heating oil for 777 euros. We just paid 1,966 euros for that same 1,000 liters of heating oil. So it's a disaster. I mean, he is a disaster, but he is a disaster for the 99%. He is a dream come true for Washington, the Council on Foreign Relations, the World Economic Forum, the CIA. He is their man. And right. But you turn on the French television, and you don't see this. You don't hear it. The yellow vests are invisible. That guy you quoted never sees the light of day except on press TV and other alternative websites. So it is just propaganda, 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 and the big lie propaganda machine makes sure that the 1% candidate gets in, and that's happened with Sarkozy and Hollande, and now with Macron, and he will get in for the second in the second round.
Well, Arnold August, how can that be turned around? A and B, do you think the French will be able to see through that, based on what our guest there from Normandy said? Because obviously, inflation, whether it's energy, food prices, basic goods, is going through the roof in many cases.
Well, I have to be an optimistic guy this morning. And, you know, France has its revolutionary traditions going back several centuries. And they have stood up to a lot of the neoliberal policies that have been going on in France over the last few years. I have hope that Mélenchon will, after all, be able to get into the second round. That's what I'm hoping for. And the people I'm speaking here in Montreal are hoping for that as well. But the basic thing the headlines are the voter turnout is down. One. Why? They don't say so, but the voter turnout is down because all the emphasis are on those two, you know, one, as the previous speaker said, the two 1% candidates who are not like the vast majority. So will their political consciousness be sharp enough, rebellious enough to make a break from the status quo, focus only on those two 1% candidates, and make a move to try to get Mélenchon into the second round, which I still think is possible.
I'm going to now end it with a quote. I'm stuck between Le Pen and Macron. I'm going to go with Le Pen. If I can ask you, Jeff Brown, this is what she has said in her campaign trail. The presidential election day is a very important day because, considering the situation of the country and the world, it will determine the course of not only the next 5 years, but also possibly the next 50 years. Do you agree with her?
It may be a little bit hyperbolic, but yeah, this is an important time for France and an important election. She lost 34% to 66% in 2017, and my wife and I voted for her in the second round because we knew that Macron was a train wreck to kill the working people in the 99%. I think Macron is still going to win, but the margin will be less. But he will, unfortunately, sadly, is still going to win.
Okay, we're going to have to end it there. Thank you, Jeff Brown, radio host and journalist from Normandy. Arnold August, a pleasure, author and journalist there from Montreal. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapway, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad.
His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: لا تجعلوا علمكم جهلا ويقينكم شكا، إذا علمتم فاعملوا، وإذا تيقنتم فأقدموا.
Imam Ali stated, "Do not turn your knowledge into ignorance or your conviction into doubt. When you gain knowledge, act upon it, and when you acquire conviction, proceed on its basis." Dear friends, it's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Dear friends, the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is truly universal. And we say so because we find that even after the passing of well over 1,000 years, which is truly a long time, we find that despite the passing of well over 1,000 years, the statements and the behaviors and the manners and the decisions and the characteristics and qualities and persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam are still very much applicable to this present day and age. Now, this can only come about if an individual is connected to the creator of time, the creator of space, and truly the source of knowledge and wisdom, that is, the Almighty Allah. In this holy month of Ramadan, we can benefit so much from the beautiful statements of Imam Ali alayhi salam. One such statement which we find from Imam Ali alayhi salam is where His Eminence says, "Ease and peace of mind will never come to a person who is jealous." In today's day and age, where everybody is looking for just a little bit of ease and peace of mind, this statement from Imam Ali seems like a golden prescription given to us by a doctor, a physician who is connected to the divine. Are we not all looking for peace of mind, even if it is just a little bit? Imam Ali alayhi salam says to us that if you are a person who has the quality of being jealous, then ease and peace of mind will never come to you. It is such a beautiful statement, it is such a simple statement, but when you go into the depths of this statement from Imam Ali and this universal persona, we find that the spiritual aspects of it can be clearly seen. If, God forbid, we suffer from this negative quality of being jealous, or perhaps if we have seen other people who are jealous, you will notice that a person who is jealous has this kind of incessant greed within them. First off, they're never satisfied with what they have because they want what others have. Two, they're constantly looking at what others have, and thus they overlook what they themselves have. These two things, among the many other repercussions and consequences of being jealous, these two things alone destroy the peace of mind and tranquility of an individual. And so, dear friends, if we want to have that peace of mind, if we want to have tranquility and serenity in our lives, if we want to have ease as far as our mind and our soul and even our body goes, then we must give up this negative and bad quality, this negative habit of being jealous. And so, when we are not a jealous person, we will achieve, to some extent, that peace of mind that we are all searching for. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafiya. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, remember not to overload yourself. Do not entrust yourself with so many obligations and duties that you cannot honorably fulfill them, or with such luxurious